There is a new poll out of UW-Madison, and we're exploring it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Elections Research Center conducted an online survey this month in three swing states. The results show Senator Bernie Sanders holding a sizable lead in Michigan and Wisconsin ahead of the state's primaries. But Pennsylvania is a closer contest among Democrats. So do you trust political polling? Have you been contacted by a pollster this election cycle? What questions did they ask you? And were you truthful in your answers? The conversation is at 800-642-1234. Barry Burden is a political science professor at UW-Madison, where he directs the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
What did your polling say about the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders in battleground states?
It says that he's in a very good position in all three of the states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. He's in the lead. That lead is biggest in Wisconsin, as you mentioned at the top of the story, with 30% of the vote among Democratic primary voters here. No other candidate in Wisconsin has even half that amount, so it's a pretty sizable gap between him and then the pack of four or five who are trailing behind. His position is not quite as commanding in Michigan and even less so in Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg are doing a bit better. All three of them are within about 5 percentage points of one another. But of course, the Pennsylvania primary isn't until late April, so it's a little further along and things may be quite different in the campaign by the time they get there.
So what stood out to you in this latest survey? What are some themes that you saw?
Well, I think the most interesting one on the Democratic side is the tremendous generational divide among Democratic voters. When we combine the three states together, Bernie Sanders among 18 to 29-year-olds, the youngest group in the sample, gets 55% of the vote. So he has more support than all of the other candidates combined, just a very dominant position. But as you move across the age groups upward to those who are over 65, which is our oldest group, he's actually a second or third tier candidate. Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg are atop with over 20% of the vote. Buttigieg and Klobuchar are both competitive, and Sanders is under 10%. So it's a very different combination of candidates depending on what age group you're looking at within the Democratic Party, and Sanders' success is attributed mostly to young voters.
Age among young voters, what you're seeing there, but what about demographics? You mentioned there that you mentioned Biden leading among black voters.
He is leading among black voters. Again, we have to combine all three states to have enough respondents to look at in some of these categories. Among white voters, Sanders does well. Among Hispanic voters, he does particularly well, and I think we saw that coming out of the Nevada caucuses just this week. But among black voters, there's still loyalty to Biden. He finishes first among them with about 35% of the vote. And Sanders is really grouped with several other candidates, Bloomberg, Warren, and others, pretty far behind. So, you know, as we move from state to state, as folks are watching the campaign unfold, you see that the pattern is somewhat different, and it reflects largely demographics in the state. I think South Carolina's primary, which is coming up this Saturday, will be a nice test of that to see whether Biden is still in a good position with black voters enough to make him competitive or maybe let him win the state.
We're talking with Barry Burden, director of the Elections Research Center, which just released its first poll of the 2020 presidential race this week. More than 8 months until Election Day, what do you think of political polling? Do you pay attention to polls and what they tell us about voters? How do you see them influencing our democracy or not? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Barry, two-thirds of your respondents said America is, quote, ready to elect a woman president, yet your poll didn't find any of the female candidates in the race in first place. What do you think that means?
No, that's interesting, isn't it? I think it's ambiguous even what respondents mean when they tell us that America is ready for a woman president. It might mean that they are personally interested in seeing a woman being elected. Or it might mean that maybe the barriers to a woman being elected have fallen, and I think the U.S. would be open to that. It apparently doesn't mean they're interested in these particular women, because in the Democratic primary, at least, neither Elizabeth Warren nor Amy Klobuchar are in the top group in any of the states. Now, it's not to say that that won't happen. It's possible that one of them will break out of the pack. But at the moment, they're really, I think, second-tier candidates behind Sanders and maybe Joe Biden.
Which candidates have the strongest support among women voters?
Well, there, too, there's not a tremendous gender gap. There will be in the November election. Women will be more on the Democratic side and men more likely to vote for Trump. But in the primary, the gender differences are not large. Warren does better among women than she does among men. That's probably the most imbalanced of all the candidates. But for most of the others, the percentages between men and women are quite similar. Bloomberg does a little better among men. Biden, surprisingly, a little better among women. Klobuchar about equally between the two. So that's not a major division within the Democratic primary, at least.
The Marquette Law School poll surveyed voters here in Wisconsin last month and found former Vice President Joe Biden was the front runner. What do you think explains the change going on in the Biden campaign?
Well, Biden's had a terrible month. It's just a bad experience for him. This is someone who was a former vice president of the United States, is closely linked to the Obama administration, which was held in high regard among Democratic voters, at least. But then in Iowa, finished, I think, fifth, and Hampshire fourth, and came out of New Hampshire with zero delegates, finishing behind people like Pete Buttigieg, who was not a known figure just a year or two ago, but is now beating him in a number of states. He has suffered, I think, not getting as many endorsements as he would have liked and has been struggling in debates. Now, there's been a little recovery in recent days. He did better in Nevada than he had in the first two states. There's been some fire aimed at other candidates, in particular Bernie Sanders as the front runner and Mike Bloomberg as the new entrant in the race. So Biden may well recover, but it has been a rough February, and it's going to be a long haul for him to get back atop the field if that were to happen.
Yeah, traditionally, Biden has gone after, quote-unquote, the working class voter, but that encompasses a lot in our society. So where is the working class voter in relation to polling?
Sanders does exceptionally well among working class voters, people with less income and lower levels of educational attainment. And he's one of the few candidates who actually uses that phrase, working class. Lots of other candidates in both parties like to talk about the middle class, which is even a more ambiguous group and includes all kinds of people who think they're in the middle class. But working class is a little more specific and I think has a kind of economic edge to it that the middle class doesn't. And Sanders has been able to tap into that group, which is younger, more racially diverse, more concentrated in urban areas. And that has really been the fuel for his campaign in all of these early states so far.
So how competitive is Senator Sanders with President Trump in the general election, according to your survey?
He's very competitive, as are all the Democrats. And I think that runs against some of the chatter out there about maybe Sanders being too progressive to be electable, or that maybe Biden ought to be advantaged because he's electable, or on the other side, that Sanders has built such a movement that he would be a dominant candidate. In fact, we show in the survey that almost regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, the race is likely to be very close in Wisconsin, razor thin in Pennsylvania, maybe a little tilted towards the Democrats in Michigan, but in really all of these matchups, the differences are not beyond the margin of error. So to me, this indicates that all three states are really available for both parties to win in November and will be essential to either party's victory in the Electoral College.
UW-Madison political science professor Barry Burden is our guide to a new poll. Your thoughts on polling, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about new presidential election polling out of UW-Madison here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The poll was conducted earlier this month. It found support for Senator Bernie Sanders surging in Wisconsin. Sanders has a commanding lead over the rest of the field of Democratic hopefuls. And the survey went out to voters in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin to see what these swing state voters are thinking about the presidential race. your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Do polls inform your vote? Will President Trump be able to replicate his success in swing states this year? Share your thoughts. Again, 800-642-1234. UW-Madison political scientist Barry Burden directs the Elections Research Center, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I'd be curious to know in the survey, specifically the women that were surveyed, if they lean towards one of the women candidates more than the other, either Warren or Klobuchar, and if there's an age breakdown that shows a preference.
Mike, thanks. Any more breakdown there that you saw among the respondents who identified as women, Barry?
You know, it is surprising that there's not a bigger difference between men and women in the Democratic primary. You might expect female candidates to attract the support of female voters. There's still a lot of, I think, hand-wringing among Democratic women about what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016, but that just doesn't show up in the survey. It's true that Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren, who are the two women in the top group, do a little better among women than they do among men, but it's not a sizable gap. Warren is the most dependent on female voters. I think a strong majority of her vote comes from women, but overall, there are not big differences. It's really racial differences and especially the age differential that is separating the candidates. And that's all about Bernie Sanders, who's doing well among Hispanics and whites and doing exceptionally well among young voters.
What contrast did you see between Democratic voters in Wisconsin with those in Michigan and Pennsylvania?
Well, it's largely demographics, and I think that explains why the primary outcome looks to be a bit different across the states and why the general election is a little different. Wisconsin's electorate is whiter. There's a smaller African-American population in Wisconsin relative to Michigan, Pennsylvania. Also, levels of educational attainment are a little lower in Wisconsin, and the population's a little bit older. And those are all demographics that would help Bernie Sanders in a primary. He does better among white voters than among African-Americans, and those with less education rather than those with more. And that shows up in the poll. He's in the best position in the Wisconsin primary and not quite as dominant in Michigan and Pennsylvania. I think it also shows up in the general election matchups. The Democrats are doing a hair better in Michigan. That gets to be near the beyond the margin of error, whereas both Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are about dead even, very difficult to say. And I think that's partly just the mix of people who are in the state. So they, you know, there is the saying that demographics is destiny. And at least when it comes to elections, it's a big part of what we can expect to happen.
Let's bring in Nancy now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I thought it was very interesting that your guest described the youngest people who are most in favor of Sanders. And I think that's because that he is always promoting entirely free education. And, of course, they're the ones who are coming from college now with enormous debt loads. So, but as you go up the scale to older people, they're the ones who realize they would be the ones to pay for it. It is this year's slate of possible candidates is really interesting to watch.
Well, Nancy, I want to pause there. Barry, do you see that insight that what Sanders is offering the more youthful generation is certainly not seen in the same way by an older generation?
Yes, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Our survey did ask Democratic primary voters what the main reason was for picking their candidate. There's been a lot of discussion this year among Democrats about electability, wanting to find someone who could beat Donald Trump. And that's been the claim that, say, Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg have made about their candidacies. So we offered respondents a set of six options for why they pick their candidate. And one of them was, this person has the best chance to beat Donald Trump. But that was not the most popular pick. The most popular pick was, I picked the candidate because I agree with them on most of the issues. So prioritizing issue agreement over electability. And I think that is a big draw for Sanders supporters. They really are interested in his plans to offer free education, to cancel student loan debt, to make marijuana use legal, to enact Medicare for All as a replacement for private insurance. These are some pretty big reforms, but they sit well, at least with young voters.
Nancy, thanks for the call. We're talking with Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, where he researches U.S. elections and public opinion. We're talking about a new poll he conducted in three swing states, including Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How much attention do you pay to polling leading up to November 3rd? You can also email ideas at WPR.org. So, Barry, there are so many polls out there in the country, lots of noise, a lot of predictions. Why start another poll?
Well, it does feel like there's a lot of surveying happening. In Wisconsin and other states, even more so in Michigan and Pennsylvania, it's not quite as rich in survey data as you might think.
Hmm.
We've been really fortunate in Wisconsin to have the Marquette poll, which is a really high-quality, gold-standard-type survey running for a number of years here. I think it's been really essential for us to understand how the electorate is thinking, how voters are making up their minds, how they view the candidates, public policies, and other kinds of things. Most other states don't even have that. In both Michigan and Pennsylvania, I think there had only been one survey about the election since the fall. So in some places, there's a real dearth of this kind of information. We think that more surveys are better for understanding voters in these really key states. I can't tell you how often I hear from reporters from other countries, from Brazil and Chile and France and elsewhere, asking about what the heck is going on in Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwest. They really want to understand who's going to be elected president and what role we have to play in that in a key swing state. And I think surveys are one window into understanding how the electorate is viewing the candidates and the issues.
So 1 week from today, 14 states will hold their primaries on Super Tuesday, as it's called, the single biggest day to win delegates in the race. But Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, not among them. They'll vote later. What are you watching for out of Super Tuesday?
Well, I think just on the game of the campaign, we're interested in which candidates are likely to drop out as a result of Super Tuesday. There are so many delegates being selected that day. It's about a third of the total that will be at the Democratic convention in July. And so a candidate who can't get any traction in these 14 states, I think, is going to have trouble making a pitch that they deserve to go on, and they will have trouble raising money. And so it's quite possible that a candidate or two could be nudged out of the race. That typically happens the night of the Iowa caucuses. That's the first event, and it's sort of the first sign. There's an old saying that there are only three tickets out of Iowa, but the Iowa results were so muddled that it wasn't clear who was in the lead or how other candidates had fared, and so no one dropped out that night. It took the New Hampshire primary, which was more decisive, to push a few candidates out. Nevada has not done that. So we've got both South Carolina and Super Tuesday, I think, as the next big indications where that could happen. And then after that, I think candidates will just cruise through the states. We should expect by the time the primary happens in Wisconsin on April 7th, there should still be probably three or four viable candidates who have the money and the interest to still be in the race.
Yeah, how big of a role could Wisconsin play in our primary this year?
Well, it's both big and small. It's small because we're late in the cycle, and Wisconsin happens after about 60% of the delegates have been selected. So in that sense, Wisconsin's a minor player. On the other hand, no candidate is likely to have a majority of the delegates at that point. The field is still divided enough among the candidates that maybe no candidate will have a majority at the time even of the convention. In addition, Wisconsin is the only primary on April 7th. There's no other state holding an event that day. So I think there is an opportunity for those of us in Wisconsin to get a little attention from the candidates who will have nowhere else to go in the days just before the primary. So not likely to be the deciding factor in the outcome, but I think we'll be part of the story of framing this mix of candidates and figuring out how to think about them as we head towards the final stretch.
So as we start to wrap up here, what will you look at in future polling during the campaign season? Because this is the first one, is that right?
It is. We expect to do several surveys over the course of the 2020 campaign. There's likely to be one more before the Democratic convention in July. That's sort of a last look as the nomination is presumably wrapping up to see how voters are thinking about both Trump and Pence on the Republican side and whoever's likely to be the Democratic nominee. as the conventions are being put together. And then additional survey work after the conventions. We get into the heat of the general election. That will be in August or September. So once we know who the Democratic nominee and the running mate is, and really the choice has been clarified for folks, I think it's another opportunity to have a look and see how voters are thinking as things get more serious.
Barry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
UW-Madison political science professor Barry Burden directs the Elections Research Center. We have a link to results. Go to WPR.org/mornings. Also, new Marquette Law School poll comes out Thursday that looks at views of the presidential election. We'll have coverage of the results of that polling data on Central Time. That's Thursday at 3:45. Coming up, we look at Black History Month and talk with a professor about the cultural movement of Afrofuturism. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Pierce Freelon. He's launched organizations to address social justice issues through arts activism. Black Space in his hometown of Durham, North Carolina, focuses on youth arts. His beat-making lab has traveled the globe. In 2018, he co-directed the short film series The History of White People in America. Here's a sample.
White people, listen to this. Uh-huh. In America in the early 1600s, you didn't exist.
You didn't exist?
I hate to break it to you like this. Listen to what your history books missed. What would be made white were completely unrelated, under-melanated people. Frankenstein, collaged by an optical illusion. The ultimate mirage called race, a social construction like Santa Claus. Back in the day, y'all either English...
What do you want to know about community building and African-American visionaries? We're at 800-642-1234. Pierce Freelon is a musician, director, social entrepreneur, and a state Senate candidate in North Carolina. He will be in Wisconsin Thursday to give the keynote for UW-Madison's Black History Month celebration. Pierce, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
You really call on your ancestors. You look to respect to the continent of Africa. How do Afrofuturists, you know, look at that respect in informed by how they're living daily lives today as Black Americans?
Well, you know, my grandmother used to always say things like lift as you climb. She always used to tell me and my siblings that we stand on the shoulders of giants, our ancestors. She never wanted us to forget where we came from, which was an important part of the system of institutional slavery and white supremacy. When they brought enslaved Africans to this country, one of the first things they did was they changed your name. You know, they took away your culture and your legacy. They stopped, prevented you from practicing your ancient religious and cultural traditions. And they tried to impose a new set of traditions on us. And so it's an act of resistance to claim and to celebrate and to honor and to uplift our ancestors and remember our names and remember our traditions and follow in the footsteps of our ancestors.
In particular, Harriet Tubman is someone you look up to, think about a lot. What do you see in her?
Well, Harriet Tubman was an Afrofuturist, like so many leaders in the Black freedom struggle. If you just got to imagine, if you put yourself in Harriet's shoes and just imagine having ancestors of yours, recent mother, grandmother, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, friends, everybody enslaved, and you have a vision to move and to build into a future where slavery doesn't exist, where you can move as you choose and have the freedoms of the other folks in your society and culture. That's Afrofuturism. It took a lot of creativity, a lot of imagination, a lot of dreaming to look at your current situation and say, I can create something better for myself. And I really admire that.
How do you start on this journey today to reimagine when you look at yourself, when you look at your colleagues around you and the work that you're doing?
Well, again, going back to those ancestors, I think Black folks in this country, folks who suffered from oppression, have to be resilient, and they have to know their own worth and their own value, and they have to look at systems like institutional slavery and say, I deserve better. I can do better. And guess what? I'm going to do everything I can, pool all my resources and my intellect and my community to create that better future. That's what Harriet Tubman did. That's what Dr. Martin Luther King did when he looked at segregation and Jim Crow. You know, I deserve to be able to attend the elite educational institution of this country, to eat at the restaurants, to have the same privileges. And even today, I mean, there's still a broad, sweeping set of systems, from the education system, the prison industrial complex, where Black folks are disproportionately targeted. Policing, there's a lot of different areas where having Black or brown skin puts you at a disadvantage relative to other people. And we believe that we can do better and that we deserve more. And so I think for me, the biggest thing is to remember that I had ancestors who made the same observations that I was making and who fought and struggled and persevered and were resilient in the face of oppression.
So much of your work is tied to the arts. How do you see the arts and science and technology all connected to Afrofuturism?
Well, the arts have always been a tool of African people to get free. I mean, you brought up Harriet, so I'm going to keep going back to her. Harriet Tubman used spirituals as coded language to help people get free. Spirituals like, you know, Go Down Moses. These would be, you know, coded language, private messages to enslaved Africans that, hey, the Underground Railroad is coming through tonight. This is your cue. Songs like Wade in the Water were instructions on how to escape slaves, to go through the water so the slave catching dogs can't smell you. During the civil rights movement, we've had, you know, going as far back to Ida B. Wells before the civil rights movement, and Billie Holiday with her song Strange Fruit. You know, this is music, changing public perceptions, helping open up those emotional and empathetic channels to tell people about the terrors of lynchings. It was music that did that. And it was music that, you know, helped lead us in the fight against the war in Vietnam, you know, whether it's Marvin Gaye or even up to the present with hip hop. Music and art has been a really important tool for oppressed people to make critiques of systems of oppression and to find comfort and to chart a path forward that is emancipatory and that celebrates the full humanity of the oppressed people.
We're talking with Pierce Freelon, who is a musician, a college instructor, a social entrepreneur. We're looking at Afrofuturism and what it means today, looking back at ancestors. How do you think Afrofuturism can change the world? What does it mean to you? How did you get introduced to it? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Pierce, explain for us, because the term Afrofuturism was only coined like in the early 1990s. Where did it come from?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were people like DJ Spooky and folks out in California who coined the term. But the idea behind it has been around a lot longer than the actual system. And sometimes it takes us a while to name things, you know, things like a word like patriarchy or sexual harassment. You know, these are words that were also kind of, you know, coined in the 90s that came into our conscience more recently. But, you know, we know good and well that sexism existed. Well, sexism specifically, I was talking about sexual harassment was a term that is more recent, but the systems that undergird these terms and the scholarship and the people thinking and working through these ideas has been around much longer. Racism is a newer term than the actual system of white supremacy. So I think sometimes it takes our words a little bit of time to catch up to reality, but Afrofuturism is in that same boat. As I mentioned, several Afrofuturists already, but it's just Black folks who have the courage and the creativity and the imagination, which is why art is an important part. It requires an imagination, because you have to look at the world as it is and say something better is possible. And that's something, you know, not just Black folks, futurists of different backgrounds have been doing for a long time. And we need people with a creative vision for the future to help chart our path forward. Otherwise, we'll be kind of lethargic and kind of you know, entrenched in our current ways. And there are a lot of people who are stuck in their ways. And then there's always the innovators. And oftentimes it comes from a younger generation for people, you know, to craft a new future.
I want to look for a moment at the film space and the movie Black Panther in particular from 2018, nearly all black cast. And it really inspired young people connecting to Afrofuturism as perhaps a genre. What did you see there?
Yeah, Black Panther is a wonderful film. You know, the director, though, if you look back at his body of work, Ryan Coogler, he has a number of wonderful films. He has a, you can actually Google it. If you Google Ryan Coogler, he has a film on Vimeo. It was his first film that he made when he was still in college. He's a football player and made a film called Locks about a guy who's walking down the street and being basically racially profiled because of his hair. And he goes to the barbershop to cut his hair off. Presumably you think as you're watching, spoiler alert, by the way, I'm telling you what happened. He gets his hair cut, supposedly to, you know, avoid being persecuted. And then when he gets home and sits down next to his sister who takes off a wig, you find out that his sister has cancer and he was actually cutting his hair to be in solidarity with his sister who is dealing with this illness. It's a short film. It's a silent film. And it's really incredibly moving and incredibly powerful and just talks about perception and race and health and wellness and family and brotherhood, sisterhood. And, you know, when you go back, there's a word Sankofa. It means you need to look back in order to move forward. If you look back at this body of work from Ryan Coogler and then look at Fruitvale Station and Creed and, you know, what built up to Black Panther, it makes complete sense that he would make such a gem, such a masterpiece. You know, I just think that it's really important that black makers and black creators are leveraging popular culture to tell our stories from our perspectives and to provide that nuanced vision that only people from that culture can present. And especially, you know, when I think about Black Panther in the context of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, I'm a huge comic book fan, but you know, we got Iron Man 1, 2, and 3, Thor 1, 2, and 3, three Captain Americas, two Guardians of the Galaxy, like so many movies centering light men, Doctor Strange, Ant-Man, like all before we got one black superhero movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And of course, it was the biggest one of them all, of the solo films outside of the Avengers group films. But that just shows how resilient we can be if we're just given a shot, you know.
We're talking with arts activist and entrepreneur Pierce Freelon as we explore reimagining the black future. What do you want to know about beat making? How would you describe black existence today, where it's headed? How do you connect with your black ancestors to the struggles they felt and experienced? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Afrofuturism here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is the reimagining of the future for black people through various mediums, through the arts, through media, through literature, with a strong connection to the past. And Pierce Freelon lives and breathes this cultural movement. In 2012, he co-founded the Beatmaking Lab. The PBS web series won an Emmy in 2015. Here's a sample. Goma, where my people need Amani. This is what you get when you stand up. The time is now, say Wakati. They see me and ask, Kuna Tokowapi. Where you from? Carolina, but I'm really an African son. How does the African son? What does Afrofuturism mean to you? How is your community celebrating it? Who are your heroes? What did they say and do that inform how you live your life today? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. And Pierce Freelon, the musician, the director, the social entrepreneur, he stays with us. So, Pierce, we just heard a tiny bit of the beat-making lab work. This took you to Democratic Republic of Congo, Panama, Senegal. What was the aim here?
The aim was to teach a curriculum on electronic music production. It was started as a class at UNC Chapel Hill, and like many classes, you get your 3 credit hours, you learn how to do something. And in the music department specifically, where we have a focus on classical and jazz music, it was pretty innovative at the time in 2011, 2012 to be offering a class that teaches hip hop, you know, that elevates rap to the same level as jazz vocals or opera, that elevates DJing up there with classical piano and guitar. So the idea with Beatmaking Lab started as a class, and then quickly transformed into this community program. My colleague Applejuice Kid and I, along with Dr. Mark Katz, who would later become the chair of our department, really saw the need to expand the reach of the curriculum from the campus into the community. And we did our first pilot program in the Congo, and then it was off to the races because PBS became interested and got involved as a funder and wanted to create a web series out of the program. So the first project in the Congo was just something that we, you know, crowdsourced the money for ourselves. We did an Indiegogo, raised money independently from members of the community to buy equipment and plane tickets, and we captured that in a short film that we put on YouTube, and that got on PBS's radar, and they said, we want you to expand this and to do this all around the country and around the world.
You're a musician, you're a hip hop artist, you're a social entrepreneur, but you're also running for a political office, specifically the state Senate seat in your home of North Carolina, Durham. How does politics inform your art and vice versa?
My art is very informed by music. My politics, my policies is very informed by art. I ran for mayor before I ran for state Senate in 2017, and it was really from a space of Afrofuturism. It was looking at the country and looking at the community that I was born and raised in, that I've lived in my whole life, and wanting to see some change that I wasn't seeing as a part of the agenda or the priority of folks who were holding office and were in power. And it was people like Maya Angelou, who passed away in the mid-2000s. She was close friends with my grandmother, and she had a poem which went on to inspire my policy platform. It was her poem, A Pledge to Our Youth, says, this is what we need for our kids. She said, we need clean and well-furnished schools, safe and non-threatening streets, and employment which makes use of our talents but does not degrade our dignity. You know, that's education, that is public safety, that's jobs. But it's told through the lens of poetry and through art from one of the world's most treasured poets, one of America's icons of poetry. So, you know, we built a platform inspired by those words. And as a state senator, I'm going to fight to make sure that, you know, education, public safety, housing, you know, that these things are a priority and that Black folks are centered as we look at how policies impact communities of color, because oftentimes in this country, these policies are made without the African-American community in mind.
Well, let's take a piece of that with education. You have in Durham a digital makerspace that you founded, Black Space. What kind of work is done there, and how are you trying to fit that into Afrofuturism?
Well, Black Space deals with the digital divide. Right now, we have this booming tech sector in Silicon Valley, and Durham is in a unique position as a tech hub in the South, a quickly growing tech hub with a brilliant digital, Black Space is a digital makerspace, but we are housed in American Underground, which is a startup hub. It's an incubator, it's an accelerator for small businesses and startups. A lot of tech folks, a lot of folks that are doing work in the field of medicine. And so in collaboration with American Underground, we are providing a space to bridge the digital divide because there's not a lot of diversity, frankly, in Silicon Valley. And Durham is in a unique position to be the Silicon Valley of the South. And we have a lot of businesses that are minority owned, that are owned by Black and brown folks, that are owned by women. And Black space is an important part of that conversation. We train kids in things like coding and 3D printing and music and poetry. And that art and science piece are kind of seamless when we are working with kids to try to expose them to career paths that can lead to living wage jobs and help provide opportunities for kids to take advantage of some of these jobs. Because right now there are a lot of jobs that the United States is needing to get people from outside of this country to occupy because our folks aren't trained up. We don't have the training. We don't have the skills to get a lot of the jobs that are available. And so we need programs, especially programs for Black and Brown youth, to kind of give them some early exposure to some of these STEM-driven jobs.
STEM fields, yeah. Pierce Freelon is our guide here, founder of Black Space. It's a digital makerspace, the host of Beatmaking Lab. And he'll be giving the keynote presentation Thursday at a Black History Month celebration on the UW-Madison campus. Your thoughts on Afrofuturism at 800-642-1234. Pierce, I want to ask you a bit of a personal question. You have a unique tattoo on your left arm of a pyramid. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. I'm looking at it right now. So this was my father's the first logo of his business. My dad, Phil Freelon, who passed away last year on July 9th and who I just found out was celebrated and honored at the NAACP Image Awards over the weekend. I wasn't watching, but I got a bunch of calls from my friends. Oh, we saw your dad. Hmm. He's the architect who designed the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. He's done a number of other museums, the Harvey Gantt African American Museum in Charlotte, the Civil Rights Museum in Atlanta, the Reginald F. Lewis Museum in Baltimore, the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. So this guy does Black museums.
That's but where did the pyramid come from?
Well, so his first architecture company, the Freelon Group, which was started in the 90s, this logo was of a pyramid. It's a kind of a three-dimensional bird's eye view rendering of a pyramid, and the reason he chose a pyramid for his logo was because he was recognizing and honoring and celebrating the African legacies and, the roots of mathematics and science that come from Africa. People like Imhotep, you know, one of the architects of the, you know, the great pyramids of Giza. These folks, they come from Egypt, which is in Africa, and it was important for him to trace his roots as an architect back to those African regions.
Pierce, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Pierce Freelon is a musician, social entrepreneur, budding politician running for a state Senate seat in his native North Carolina. He'll be the keynote speaker for the Black History Month celebration at UW-Madison on Thursday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.